All right. Good morning. I'd like to call the meeting of the Air District for December 4th, 2019 to order. It's a very special day today for a number of reasons, but maybe top of the list is it is Director Bowder's birthday.
Maybe he wants to describe what happened at the end of his council meeting last night.
No, we'll save that to the end.
Okay, thank you, please.
Happy birthday. Marcy, can we have a roll call, please?
On the roll for the Board of Directors meeting of December 4th, 2019, Director Abe Koga, Director Barrett.
Here.
Director Bowders, Director Canepa, Director Cutter, Director Joya.
Here.
Director Groom, Director Haggerty. Director Hudson.
Here.
Director Hurt.
Present.
Director Ju.
Here.
Director Niss.
Yeah.
Director Marr.
Here.
Director Miley. Director Mitchoff. Director Ross. Director Sparing.
Present.
Director Wagon Connect.
Here.
Director Walton. Director Wilson. Director Zane. Secretary Chavez. Vice Chair Sinks.
Here.
Chair Rice.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. And now we'll do the pledge. Oh, can Director Bowders lead us, please, birthday boy?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, Marcy, do we have any public comment this morning?
No.
Okay, so we will, can we move on to item number three? Jack? Yes? Is Assemblymember Wicks here? So should we, is she coming? So I think we should table this till she. Yeah. Okay. We're gonna hold off on item number three, and we're gonna move on to the consent calendar. Items 4 through 10. Do I have any interest in taking anything off consent or discussing anything on consent?
Second.
I have a motion and a second to approve the consent calendar. Marcy, any public comment? So, if we approve unanimously? Okay. Consent calendar is approved. So now we're on to committee reports. This is item number 11. We'll have the report of the Budget and Finance Committee. And I do not see Director Groom, and so I would ask Director Bowders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The committee met on Monday, November 25th, 2019, and approved the minutes of April 22nd, 2019. The committee reviewed and discussed the staff presentation on the fourth quarter financial report for the fiscal year ending June 2019. The committee reviewed and discussed the staff presentation on the first quarter financial report for the year ending 2020. Finally, the committee reviewed and discussed the staff presentation on California's employers' pension pre-funding trust participation and considered to recommend adoption. The Air District staff presented three potential strategies on how to pay down long-term liabilities for its California Public Employee Retirement System pension, I'm sorry, with a possible recommendation for use of the California Employers Pension Pre-Funding Trust Program administered by the California Public Employees Retirement System to pre-fund pension obligations. The committee chose to delay action on that recommendation so that staff can hold additional meetings with representatives from several Section 115 trust options and present more details of those programs. The next meeting for the Finance and Budget Committee will be held on Wednesday, February 26, 2020 at 9:30 a.m. This concludes the report for this committee.
Thank you. So any discussion on the Budget and Finance Committee report? All right, seeing none, we're going to move on to item 12, which is a report from the Legislative Committee. And I don't see Director Abe Koga here, so it is your
day.
This
is a setup. Wow.
Director Bowders.
The report of the Legislative Committee. Madam Chair, the Legislative Committee also met on Monday, November 25th, 2019, and approved the minutes from the October 9th, 2019 meeting. The committee then discussed the Air District's 2019 budget priorities, including potential bond ballot measures for 2020, Assembly Bill 617 funding for implementation and incentives of the Community Air Protection Program, reductions in the California's Cap and Trade Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, and Assembly Bill 836 funding for the Wildfire Smoke Clean Air Centers and Vulnerable Populations Incentive Pilot Program. Finally, the committee received an update on the Air District's legislative priorities for 2020, including the possible legislation to provide additional indirect source authority over mobile sources and the pursuit of ways to address a current lack of oversight of private and charter school construction. The next meeting for the legislative committee will be done at the call of the chair. This concludes the chair's report for the legislative committee, Madam Chair.
Well done. Thank you. Now, there's no discussion. We'll move on to item number 13, which is a report from the Climate Protection Committee for the meeting of December 2nd. Chair Barrett.
I feel I should yield to Director Bowers.
I am tapped out.
The Climate Protection Committee met on Monday, December 2nd, and approved the minutes of June 10th and of September 19th, 2019. The committee received and discussed the staff presentation, Air District Building Decarbonization Program. The committee then received and discussed the presentation, Marin County Low Carbon Concrete Ordinance, presented by Alice Zanmiller from the County of Marin's Community Development Agency. Finally, the committee received and discussed the presentation, Building Electrification Trends and Opportunities, presented by Panama Bartholomew, Director of the Building Decarbonization Coalition. The next meeting of the Climate Protection Committee will be held Thursday, February 20th, 2020, at 9:30 a.m. This concludes the chair report of the Climate Protection Committee.
Thank you. Director Zinks, comment?
Yeah, I took a look at the... I'm very excited about this because, among other things, right, we have a cement plant in my city's backyard, and the idea of producing greener cement is very appealing. And one of the things I noted is with more energy efficiency in our buildings, the staff report says, and this is on page 4 of the slides, that embodied emissions, that is, the emissions from building buildings, actually are larger and predominant, larger than operating carbon emissions over the life of the building. And I wonder if it might be appropriate for staff to elaborate here or in a future meeting. And this seems like such a great idea that Marin has adopted that perhaps we figure out how we socialize their leadership. Jack or Chair, do you have a comment?
And in fact, Jack, if you could, or maybe someone else is here on staff to talk a little bit about just high level on that, the ordinance that Director Zinks is talking about. And I see our guest of honor, Assemblymember Wicks, is here, and I would love for her to hear just real briefly about this ordinance that was developed with funding from the Air District.
Yes, Madam Chair. And Director Sinks, as part of the effort in the development of this model ordinance is to actually communicate with the other counties and other municipalities in the Bay Area. So we're going to be developing an outreach plan to be able to communicate this ordinance to other jurisdictions here in the Bay Area as part of that effort. And I think what we were trying to do is give you a status update as part of the Climate Protection Committee.
I appreciate that.
More to come.
So cities in San Mateo County and Santa Clara County have organized to try to promote REACH codes, right, which have to be adopted by each city to decarbonize by electrifying buildings. But I think this is a worthy next step for cities to consider in adopting codes that would really make a significant impact in terms of carbon reduction construction. So thank you.
Yeah, and one of the things that was brought up in our discussion around this ordinance, which in a nutshell basically directs for construction using that's requiring concrete, which is generally made with cement, and the whatever the component is of that that in its development produces a lot of greenhouse gases. Not the technology person on this one, but bottom line, though the ordinance was adopted at a local level and can be adopted by local municipalities that may not be doing that much construction in and of themselves, unless you're something like San Francisco, it really speaks to the there would be some power in having some code adopted at the state level eventually and or more broadly. So anyway, concrete, embodied concrete emissions are said to account for, 6 to 8% of all greenhouse gas emissions worldwide. So.
And congratulations to the chair here for being part of that body that adopted this in Marin and showed leadership.
Okay, so that was the Climate Protection Committee report. Any other comments? Sorry. We're all good? Okay, so I think now we're going to move on back to item number 3. And this was our opportunity to recognize the leadership and help and partnership of Assemblymember Buffy Wicks. And Assemblymember Wicks, thank you so much for being here today and for your help with this important legislation. So we are here today to recognize Assemblymember Wicks. She represents, as you all know, the California's Assembly District 15, which is the communities Pinole, San Pablo, Richmond, Albany, Berkeley, Emeryville, and Oakland. And I am just going to go ahead and read this resolution.
Sure.
So in recognition and appreciation of Assemblymember Buffy Wicks, for her services in improving public health and air quality in the Bay Area. Whereas Assemblymember Buffy Wicks, representing the district, California Assembly District 15, has partnered with the Air District and authored Assembly Bill 836, Wildfire Smoke Clean Air Centers for Vulnerable Populations Pilot Program, to mitigate the adverse public health impacts due to wildfires and other smoke events. And whereas Assemblymember Wicks received broad statewide support from cities, counties, public health agencies, environmental groups, and air districts for Assembly Bill 836, which will provide funding through a grant program to retrofit ventilation systems to create a network of clean air centers at schools, community centers, senior centers, sports centers, libraries, and other publicly accessible facilities. Whereas Assemblymember Wicks and her staff advanced Assembly Bill 836 through committees in both the California Assembly and Senate without receiving a single no vote in opposition, resulting in a truly unanimous bipartisan bill signed by Governor Gavin Newsom on October 2, 2019. And whereas Assembly Bill 836, Wildfire Smoke Clean Air Centers for Vulnerable Populations Pilot Program, we need a shorter name next time, is the first program of its kind in the United States and fills a vital gap in the public health response to wildfire smoke events. Now, therefore, be it proclaimed that the Board of Directors of the Bay Area Air Quality Management District and the Executive Management Team hereby recognize the distinguished contributions of Assemblymember Wicks in serving to improve air quality and public health for all residents of the Bay Area. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'll bring this up to you in a second, but I think there might be a couple folks who would like to say something, and we'd love to hear from
sure.
you. Director Joya?
I'll go ahead and start.
Jack starts.
So, Assemblywoman Wicks, I just want to also personally thank you on behalf of the Air Quality Management District. We haven't got a chance to meet, but I know you have been working very closely, Alan, up in Sacramento. I think the resolution says it all. It is the first of its kind, and it, in our minds, represents an important gap-filling effort in the sense that we generally at the Air District want to be able to regulate things that cause such bad public health consequences. You can't generally do that with wildfires, but we can take that next step, and that is to protect public health, and that's what these clean air centers are going to ultimately do for us. So I want to personally thank you and just phenomenal leadership, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Assemblymember Buffy, thanks for really stepping up. Buffy, that's what we call you back in Richmond, so we'll call you that in here, right? Thanks for stepping up on this, because it was more than really just working through the policy, but I know the politics that it takes, and really you're great, your energy, your leadership, you know, really reaching across the aisle, getting support from the governor, and you really you know, took on a major role and you made this happen. So we appreciate that, and it goes clearly well beyond your assembly district, right? This really has implications to protect especially vulnerable populations. We've already talked about in Contra Costa County, how do we sort of help create these centers and getting our own folks educated about our own county buildings and how we can make them available. So I think this bill is really formed as a model. So thank you for your personal sweat and effort on this.
Director Bowders.
Thank you. So we'll go from Assemblymember Wicks to Buffy to Friend. Friend, I just want to thank you for all the reasons everyone else has already said. You represent us so well in Northern Alameda County. But I just want to take a personal step, and it's working in Sacramento, it's really hard to do this job. There are not enough women representing us in Sacramento, and there are very few of them who do it as a mom of a little kid. And you do all of it really well, and I just want to thank you for that.
Yeah. Am I on here?
You're on.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much. It's very sweet. You know, the issue of wildfires, you know, my dad fought wildfires for 35 years for the U.S. Forest Service, and I grew up in the Sierra Nevadas, and so it's a very personal issue for me. So that's why I felt like this was critical. And when you think about the most important element of life is breathing clean air. And so, and I know that you all know that, and you think about that every day and the policies and the work that you're doing. And so I just want to thank you all for the work that you do every single day to ensure the citizens of the Bay Area have the ability to breathe that clean air, which is very, very critical. And a lot of the reasons why I want to do this bill is because of my daughter. She just turned 3 last weekend, and I think about the world that she's going to grow up in. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, our new normal now, given our climate change goals, is these wildfires. And there's a lot we need to do to mitigate against that. But what we have to do is prepare for it so that our most vulnerable people in our communities, our homeless, our seniors, you know, people with compromised immune systems and others who, when the wildfires hit, they are most dramatically impacted by this, have a place to go. You know, when you look at the East Bay, where I live, many places don't have ventilation systems because we don't have air conditioners. We don't have these things because of the climate we live in. And so supporting this type of work is critical. It's really the reason why I ran for this seat. And so I'm honored to be doing this work with you all up in Sacramento and want to continue the work, hopefully for the next 11 years, because I just got elected. So appreciate all you guys do and appreciate the recognition tremendously.
Well, thank you so much. And I'd like to ask Director Joya and Bowders and anyone who else would be from District 15. Is that it? Would you like to all like to present this and get a little photo? Anyway, thank you so much.
Yeah, we made a big deal of it. He read 2 reports because the chairs weren't here. Ledge and finance.
My big head out of there. This is time.
Jack will block us. Yeah.
Madam Chair, if I could say a couple words before we go on to the next item.
You may.
So just to give a little bit of extra appreciation to Assemblymember Wicks for the board to know. So 1 year ago today, 1 year ago yesterday, she was sworn in to the California Assembly, and and before she even had a set of staff in Sacramento, we contacted her office to ask her to consider running the bill. And so we actually found out who her staff members were going to be before they started their jobs, and contacted them to find out what their emails were going to be when they showed up at work the following week. And so when they were waiting, when they showed up at work, we had a bill for them to consider, and they graciously took it up. And as you mentioned, she went through the entire process without a single no vote. And so I think it speaks definitely to the support that she gave the Air District and the work of her staff, and especially her legislative aide Samantha Hoon, who did a lot of work to help us get to the finish line on that. So we appreciate that. And also, the board is aware, after this, we're taking Assemblymember Wicks on a tour of the Richmond AB 617 community, Richmond San Pablo area, to show her the work that we've been doing in the 617 realm to further acquaint her with the work we're doing here.
Excellent. Well, I cultivate those relationships even further. I suspect Assemblymember Wicks is going to be a real strong partner for this Air District, as well as for other good causes going forward. So thank you, Alan, for that work. Good job by all, and on we go. So we are on item number 14, I believe, which is a public hearing to consider adoption of proposed amendments to Rule 12, Miscellaneous Standards of Performance Rule, Regulation 12, Rule 15.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Board of Directors. As part of Assembly Bill AB 617, the state legislature gave the California Air Resources Board the task of harmonizing reporting across air districts. And as part of that, they adopted in December 2018 the reporting of criteria air pollutants for toxic air contaminants. This rule phases in over three reporting periods starting in 2020, affecting our largest facilities, first our refinery facilities. As you know, our regulation 1215 was adopted prior to the Air Resources Board's AB 617 efforts. And this morning we are presenting you with essentially what is a housekeeping effort to harmonize the reporting deadlines for our rules and the new ARB CTR rule. To take us through the presentation, we have Mark Gage, an engineer from our refinery engineering group.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So, yeah, I would just like to reiterate what Mr. Breen had said. This is about adoption of proposed amendments to Regulation 12, Rule 15. This was adopted just 3 years ago in April 2016 and had three main goals in mind. The first of which was to monitor crude slate characteristics over time. The second of which was to establish air monitoring systems at the fence line of these subject facilities. And lastly, which what we are discussing today, tracking of air emissions at these facilities over time. I'm sorry, I'll speak a little louder. So when we're talking about what these reports are, what we're referring to are the annual emissions inventories. We split these into three different categories based on their pollutant type, which are listed here: criteria air pollutants, toxic air contaminants, or TACs, and greenhouse gases, GHGs. Currently, the rule is written such that these facilities are obligated to submit these reports to the Air District on June 30th of each year. And since this rule was adopted in 2016, the Air District has so far received 3 years' worth of these inventories for calendar years 2016, 2017, and 2018. So if we had not changed the rule today, then we would expect 2019's annual emissions to be reported to the Air District on June 30th next summer. As has been mentioned, the impetus for this change is in relation to CARB's relatively new regulation, the regulation for the reporting of criteria air pollutants and toxic air contaminants. It was amended, or rather adopted, in December 2018. And the items that are relevant to this discussion are the due dates that it established with regard to specific reporting requirements. These due dates are, number one, starting that these facilities must submit the obligate reports by May 1st or earlier, as determined by the Air District, to the Air District. And then subsequently, the Air District will review these reports and submit them to CARB by August 1st. So what we are proposing to amend this rule to accommodate these changes are to make these reports due on April 15th of each year. You'll notice that there is a fourth item on this list, verified greenhouse gases. This is outside the scope of both Rule 1215 and the CETR regulation, but it is a greenhouse gas report that currently is obligated to be prepared by the facility, verified by a third party, and submitted directly to CARB. So we have asked, while we're making these changes, to get a copy of that report 5 days later. And we felt it was appropriate to include those changes at this mm-hmm. time. With regard to rule development for this rule, you can see the beginning of the timeline. In June of this year, we proposed the first amendments of this rule, which originally had asked for a date of January 15th instead of April 15th. That was basically calculated based on back calculating from the August 1st submission date using the timelines that we currently have in the rule. With that, we presented at the Stationary Source Committee on July of 2019, with comments due the week later on July 15th. In September 9th, we met with stakeholders in response to their comments and discussed what this process would look like going forward. September 12th, after these discussions, we communicated to the Western States Petroleum Association that we are proposing the date of April 15th, 2020, which is 2 weeks prior to the date required by CARB of May 1st. The current draft was submitted for public comment on November 1st, which were due on November 22nd. The comments that were received from the Western States Petroleum Association requested a one-year delay in implementation of this rule such that they would not be obligated to provide these reports until April 15th of 2021. We are here today for the public hearing to address these changes. So with regard to how this will impact the district, it is possible that it might impact staffing load, assuming that these facilities that are subject to this rule do not implement the measures that have been discussed with them to facilitate this review process. I will say we've reviewed these inventories for 3 years, so over time both the facilities and the air district have gotten better at doing that, and so our review and response periods have been shortened and don't really need as much time as they used to in the past. However, part of the agreement that we had with these facilities is that they would facilitate the process by meeting with us in advance and providing more data that might be available to make sure that when we receive their inventories on April 15th, we can review them adequately for the subsequent submission to CARB on August 1st. The CTR regulation, I'll tell you, is not exclusive to just this rule. It will have impacts for other facilities in the district, and so fees might require adjustment, but that is outside the scope of the current Rule 1215 proposal. With regard to the California Environmental Quality Act, the nature of this rule is administrative. We don't anticipate or expect any changes to emissions, and there is no possibility of causing significant environmental effects. For that purpose, we consider it exempt from the CEQA requirements, or rather intend to file a notice of exemption. The specific subdivision that we believe is applicable is listed here as Section 15061. So I think. Do you have any questions? Sorry. Okay. I wasn't sure if we were quite ready. All right. So I guess with that, we'll start with a recommendation for the Board of Directors to approve filing of a CEQA notice of exemption for these proposed amendments.
Thank you. Questions? Director Joya.
This is a comment, and I know Chair of Stationary Source may observe this as well. We had a discussion about this at Stationary Source and agreed with this change in order to harmonize. We had a fair amount of discussion about the reasoning and agreed with the need to harmonize the dates between the Air Resources Board and the Air Quality Management District, and that would make the best sense.
Director Ross.
Thank you. On the When you have a scenario where you have the submitted data by the refineries and then you have a third-party verification, and I see that we've had a couple years of data to get, I guess it's called the ground truth. Who's the arbiter when there's a discrepancy, when there's a big delta between the verified and the reported? Who's the ultimate arbiter of those discrepancies?
So currently we don't ask for the verified greenhouse gas emissions. They're reported directly to the state. So when we do our verification, it's not in comparison to that report. And also, it's specifically just for greenhouse gases. It does not include the other pollutants. Mm-hmm. When it comes to just general verification, ultimately, it's, I believe, you know, we have the discretion as to what we consider the most accurate emissions for that facility.
Okay. And then if there is a discrepancy on the greenhouse gases between what's reported to the state by a third party and what we have, does anybody take notice? And or is it noted or...
I believe that's under the purview of the state. That's their, they take on that responsibility, and I believe there is a mechanism for, believe it or not, corrections after the fact, after they submit like whatever inventories they have.
On their end.
Yeah, so when we notice those types of things relative to the facilities that are regulated under the cap and trade program, we are in contact with ARB, and questions do go back and forth about various elements of the inventory. Those are generally answered by our engineering group, or if we need to, we send inspectors or source test or whatever needs to happen, contact the facility, get additional information. So those conversations happen on an ongoing basis.
Director Ju.
Thanks, Mr. Gage. I recall reading in the packet that the reasoning for the one-year delay requested by the Western State Petroleum Association, that there was no reason given for that one-year delay. Did I read that correctly, or has there been more information as to why they requested a one-year delay since we got the packet?
I believe, Director Ju, that is, you have a public comment. You have the WSPA representative here, so we can ask him that question.
Okay.
My suggestion.
Director Hudson.
Yeah, through the chair, Director Julia, I want to make sure I was clear on what you said. Stationary source recommended that the air district sync with ARB, or that they be in, you said be in sync, or the other way.
Yeah.
Harmonize.
That we harmonize the two. So there, it was brought, staff made a presentation that there were different dates of compliance from ARB and from the air district, and that it was important to harmonize the two in the way that is being suggested here before us.
Right. So everyone, Director Hudson, if it's of any help here, all the air districts are going through this same process to be able to harmonize all the emissions reporting in the state of California, and then with CARB as well, so that you can compare emissions from refineries, for example, in Southern California and here, and up and down the state, basically. So we think it's a good and right thing to be doing for the public. It just has consequences in terms of reporting processes by the facilities themselves. We have to go through a whole set of changes ourselves to be able to make this happen. But fundamentally, we need to be able to change the rules to require everything to be in sync.
And like you said, the speaker, if can finish this, you have a speaker card coming up where you can clarify this. What I was reading into this is stationary source is agreeing with what I'm reading in this letter, and now I'm not sure. So somebody clarify it when the speaker comes up.
What stationary source said was when the staff said we should harmonize the dates as are presented before us today, we agreed.
So, Marcy, do we have any public comment on this?
Bob Brown and Jed Holtzman.
Okay. Bob and Jed, come on up. Good morning.
Good morning. Bob Brown with the Western States Petroleum Association, said WSPA speaker. Thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, we've communicated with Air Resources Board, and in looking at 2019, we're almost at the end of that. This would become effectively 4 months from now. And in order to prepare all the inventories and allow for adequate time in preparation, and given the fact that the Air Resources Board has said that this can be a transition year for 2019, that the clock can essentially start on the 2020 inventory for implementation in the new timeline in 2021, that's what our request is.
Wait, just hold on.
I have a question.
Yeah, so the ARB's final regulation order provides for a phase-in schedule, section 93403A, for the 2019 reporting year.
that allows for, quote-unquote, pardon me, business as usual on that deadline. So that's effectively our request, is to allow for that transition year for this year.
Okay, Bob, you could hold 1 second. Director Joy, you have a question?
My understanding, though, is that Stationary Source, that WISPO actually agreed with this need to harmonize. So,
yes.
And we're just trying to make it happen as soon as possible. And so there was no disagreement that WISPO
right.
agreed these should be harmonized. So
with the dates,
why,
and we certainly
right.
we certainly respect the ability to weigh in on this. We're just talking
yeah.
specifically, given the fact that the data for 2019, and we're 3 weeks from the end of the year, that we apply it the clock to the 2020 schedule.
What's the date that they'd have to comply by?
The difference would be reporting on April 15th versus
June 30th.
June 30th, two
right.
months we're talking about.
Right.
And the reason why I think we're proposing this is we kind of know that this is going to be a scramble, and we want to make sure before
right.
we actually have to do this for a fact and do this reporting
yeah.
that we have the ability, capacity, timelines, everything is worked
right.
out. So that's why we're going to ask
right.
the refineries who we've informed about this as late as June, as early as June of last year, to report a little early this year.
Right. And, yep. and you knew that we were working on this
right.
because you agreed to this schedule, and we talked about this in June.
Right.
Right.
But
okay.
but
yeah.
it just in terms of, yeah, so again, just looking at 2019, in the allowance that ARB is saying that 2019 can be a transition year, that was purely our request. But we appreciate the discussions, the open communication, the collaboration. So thank you, and happy holidays.
Thank you. Mr. Holtzman, good morning.
Good morning to you. Thank you all. Jed Holtzman from 350 Bay Area. As you all know, we focus a lot more on reducing emissions than their reporting. We think that, you know, this discourse really is long overdue, but I just want to highlight, because I was in the room, that the refinery emissions reduction strategy was passed by this board in December 2015. Well, there were two different meetings, but that was one of them. It was 4 years ago this month that we discussed what we were going to do to reduce refinery emissions. The emissions tracking regulation was kind of the foundation of that, but not kind of the meat of the strategy. That was going to be required to get some of the gains that we wanted to get out of the strategy. And I know that your staff will say that rules have been passed that reduce refinery emissions X percent. I want to highlight this as an example of kind of the difference between reality in terms of emissions in the air and what your staff may report. For example, this rule was passed 4 years ago this month, and we are still seeing the industry, who would prefer not to report at all, try to slow walk basic harmonization of reporting deadlines, which in theory your staff is doing for their benefit. Like, it's to the industry's benefit to only have to report one time instead of two times. So this is so far from what we need to be seeing from the refineries, and in terms of actually reducing and eliminating their fossil fuel emissions over time. When we hear these national and international proclamations about needing to have things by 2030 and eliminate by 2050, that includes, and in fact, primarily and predominantly includes their industry. The idea that we should be at this point focusing on business as usual, or like kicking it down a year just for reporting, when you've had folks coming in here for years begging you to reduce the emissions from these facilities yesterday, does not make any sense. We do not support the extra year just to harmonize the reporting deadlines. If this gets adopted, then it needs to take effect immediately, and we need to get focused on actually doing the business of this board, reducing these emissions and protecting public health. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm bringing it back here. Damian, Jack, any comments from anything?
So, Madam Chair, members of the board, as staff, we don't support the request made by the Western States Petroleum Association. This regulation has been in the works for some time, and we think what we've proposed is reasonable. So.
All right. Thank you. So, yes, Director Spearing.
Jack, what happens if the submissions aren't on time? What's the consequence? They claim that I'm assuming we're talking about a 6 month difference. What's the actual difference in months?
We currently receive the inventories June 30th, so we would be getting it April 15th. We still are in communications with the refineries, and we send them deficiency letters. So we'll still continue that process. So we realize it may not be perfect, but it'll give us time to look at it. We'll write the deficiency letters as we normally do, and we'll work with the refineries. So it's just a little bit accelerated, but the process is the same.
Okay. So, I mean, you're saying that you're going to work with them on the reporting, and yeah. So if you some anomalies or problems arise, we're going to be flexible to deal with problems.
This essentially is like the shakeout cruise. We don't want to be doing this on the year that we actually have to report this data, because if we don't have it on May 1st, the result will be tickets, because that's what the rule requires. That's what the CTR rule requires. So if we don't have full inventories, fully verified inventories to report, or they're not submitted by May 1st, that's when ARB requires those submittals to happen. And then after that, we've got an August 1st deadline to give them verified information. We've been doing this with the refinery facilities now for 3 years, the 12-15 inventories, and they are quite complex. Yeah. It takes us a while to get through them. We are pushing ourselves. We made a compromise to move the date to April. That crunches us on the back end to get that information verified. We don't want to be in a situation where we have to submit to ARB without the data being the best that it can be. So that's why we've chosen the April 15th date. And as Pam said, you know, this is essentially our shakeout cruise the first year. We want to make sure that we can do everything to the level of accuracy that it needs to be for reporting to the ARB. So in our mind, you know, a delay of 2 months at a time where we're willing to work with these folks and work through those inventories doesn't make a lot of sense to us.
Yeah. Okay, well, I just want a confirmation that since you're on this shakedown cruise, that there's going to be some flexibility. You're going to be working with the industry, and I understand the importance of this, but, you know, this is a very complex issue, and so I just want to make sure our staff is, you know, building that into this shakedown cruise, that we have that ability to work with the industry.
Director Zinks.
Thank you. Just to reiterate our discussion at the stationary source committee meeting that John was talking about for clarity, we had this discussion, I believe, at our June stationary source committee meeting. And at that time, were we still talking April 15th, August 15th, have those dates moved or changed?
The initial date. The initial date proposed was January 15th, and so
okay.
After
so we after we directed you to negotiate with industry.
Yes.
We need a bunch of time to work out and fact check and go back to the refineries and try to determine if there were anomalies in the data or missing data or whatever. We need that time. So what we've effectively done is from June. At which time we were proposing a January 15th date. Mm-hmm. We've moved this to April 15th. Mm-hmm. And that's compacting our schedule. Right. Second question, do we get relief from ARB on this August reporting milestone in August of 2020 or not? Could we not report or report late or whatever?
So this is for next year, right? For 2020, right?
For the reporting that we have to apparently do in August, is that a mandate of the state?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Then I would move this item.
Yeah. Second.
Director Ness.
Just want to make sure that I associate with what Jim Spearing said. I agree. And he always has good words of caution, and I think that was well put. Just so it's on the record, Jim, I supported you.
All right. So I have a motion and a second to recommend the filing of the CEQA notice of exemption, and also by same motion and seconder, a recommendation to adopt a resolution approving amendments to the Air District's Regulation 12 Rule 15 that would become effective December 5th, 2019. So all those...
I do need a roll call vote.
Okay, Marcy.
And may I just call the members that are present?
You may.
Okay. Director Sparing. Director Walton. Director Cutter.
Yes.
Director Ju. Director Nis.
Aye.
Director Joya.
Yes.
Secretary Chavez.
Yes.
Chair Rice.
Yes.
Vice Chair Sinks.
Aye.
Director Hudson.
Yes.
Director Haggerty. Director Wagenknecht.
Yes.
Director Ross.
Aye.
Director Barrett?
Yes.
Director Bowders?
Aye.
Director Marr?
Aye.
Director Hurt?
Yes.
The ayes have it. Motion carries.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So we will move on to item number 15, which is a climate protection update. Ms.
Yes.
Young.
Madam Chair and members of the board, we put this item on the agenda as this is your last meeting for 2019, and we thought it was appropriate for us to do somewhat of a check-in with you about the state of our climate. And also, I know Ms. Young is going to cover not only recent findings, but give you a sense of where we are in terms of our own program itself. Also, what's driving this, the need for this presentation in part, has to do with the fact that there's an international, very important international effort underway right now in Spain. It's what's referred to as the Council of Parties by the UN, or COP. This is COP25, and it just made sense for us to, in that context, to give you this presentation to review, as I said, not only our state of our climate, but our efforts as well. So,
right.
Patty?
Yeah, and I would say also well-timed per this agenda with regards to the last item we just discussed. So.
Great.
That on the back end and COP25 on the front. So, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Rice and members of the board. This morning, my presentation will give a high-level view of sort of the status of climate change and our the Air District's climate protection program, kind of to tee up as we move toward what's going to be happening on the global stage beginning next week in Madrid, as Jack mentioned. So first, I wanted to mention there have been a couple of studies, important studies, that have come out as sort of a prelude to the international negotiations in the last week. And these have been studies that have given us an update on what's going on with climate change and climate change impacts. The World Meteorological Organization and the UN Environment Program published studies, and they're both telling us basically that we're really in a world of trouble. The head of the WMO has said that there is no sign of a slowdown, let alone a decline, in greenhouse gas concentrations, despite all the pledges and commitments that have been made through international agreements like the Paris Agreement. And just this past Monday, 2 days ago, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that the point of no return is no longer over the horizon. It is in sight and hurtling toward us. So, very grave news. And these studies, to some extent, probably tell us what we already suspected, that greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise. Even if we implement and achieve all the promises made through the Paris Agreement, we would still see an over 3 degrees Celsius increase in global temperatures above pre-industrial levels. And according to the UN report, we would actually have to, starting today, reduce greenhouse gas emissions globally by 7.6% every year from now until 2030 in order to be on a pathway toward achieving the goals in the Paris Agreement, and even then we would still be significantly above pre-industrial levels. So, there's a big haul ahead of us. And then, of course, sea level rise and Arctic ice melt and all these other indicators continue to worsen. And I didn't want to list all of them because it's too depressing. Oops. But here in the Bay Area, what does this mean? So I don't think it's any news to anyone in this room that in the Bay Area we're already feeling a lot of these impacts in a number of ways. Studies conducted by the state of California are telling us that if we continue along the emission path that we're on, we will see a significant increase in extreme heat days across the state, including here in the Bay Area. Combine that with the increased occurrence and intensity of wildfires, and we are going to see worsening air quality that really will be rolling back a lot of the gains that we've made over the past few decades. Precipitation will come in dramatic cycles of booms and busts, periods of intense storm activity separated by long, protracted dry spells. Look back over this past year, and I think that's exactly what we're going to continue to see. We're looking at a major decrease in the Sierra snowpack that we rely on not only for recreation, but of course also for a lot of our drinking and irrigation water. And, I think it's important to note, we've known this for a really long time. These are the messages that climate models were and the scientific community was giving us 20 years ago. And it is happening today. So for over the past 10 years, the state of California has had an organized and prioritized strategy to address greenhouse gas emissions. And this strategy in large part has focused on regulatory measures, including the statewide cap and trade program, including regulations designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as a result of driving vehicles. So by regulating and requiring cleaner cars themselves, and then also by requiring lower carbon content in the fuels that are used. The renewables portfolio standard has been pretty successful at driving down the carbon content of our electricity. And we've also seen a more recent focus on very potent, short-lived climate pollutants like methane as part of the statewide strategy. But the state has also used non-regulatory measures to get at some of the more complex sources of emissions that arise from land use patterns and planning. The Governor's Office of Planning and Research issues guidance on how to address greenhouse gas emissions through general plans, through local climate action plans, and through the CEQA process. And I think, as we all know, the SB 375, the Sustainable Communities Strategy, connects transportation and housing planning and policy in order to encourage infill and transit-oriented development. So that, in a kind of a high level, that has been the statewide approach to date. So where are we? 2017 was the last year for which the California Air Resources Board has a finalized statewide greenhouse gas emissions inventory. So this chart shows us the track represented by the blue line of actual emissions in the state from 2000 through 2017. And that dashed green line represents what our 2020 greenhouse gas emission reduction target is. The target is to reduce statewide greenhouse gas levels to 1990 levels by the year 2020. And as you can see, as of about 2 years ago, we had met and exceeded that target. So that is great. And recently, Governor Newsom announced that he has directed the Department of Finance to leverage the state's $700 billion CalPERS, CalSTRS, and UC retirement program portfolio to drive investment for carbon neutral technologies. So a lot is coming out of the state.
But getting, this is the short-term target, this is 2020, and getting where we need to be over the long term is another matter. So both the state of California and the AIR District, this board, have adopted a the same long-term target to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. Now, we have 30 years to get there. And, of course, we don't know all of the technologies and other kinds of innovations that will emerge that will help us along that path. But what we do have today is our 2017 Clean Air Plan that lays out a region-wide climate protection strategy to move us along that pathway toward 2050. And key priorities within this plan include eliminating fossil fuels in buildings. And we heard a little bit of discussion about that in the report out from the Climate Protection Committee. We just had a meeting on Monday where the committee really dug down deep into this issue and heard from some outside speakers about potential pathways to getting to eliminating fossil fuels in buildings. We want to continue to promote and incentivize zero emission vehicles. We also need to significantly reduce vehicle travel, and that is probably the hardest piece of this puzzle. And we need to reduce organic material from the waste stream, which, because of its associated methane emissions, will also help us with that last bullet point, reducing what we call super GHGs. Those are the greenhouse gases that are particularly potent in terms of their impact on global warming. Oh, animations. There we go. So what's our approach? We're breaking down the major greenhouse gas pollutants. We're looking at each one of these and looking at the different sources in our regional inventory that contribute to each of these different pollutants. Then we're matching them up with the tools that the AIR District has at its disposal and defining the best role for the AIR District in addressing each of these pollutants and prioritizing the different actions that, we're going to take over time. Now, as you all know, local governments are key partners and always have been in the AIR District's overall climate protection approach. And supporting local action to reduce greenhouse gases has really been the cornerstone of our climate protection program since it began about 15 years ago. So as we address each of these pollutants, we are focusing on ways that we can bring our expertise, our knowledge, and our resources to accelerate the policy adoption and the program implementation at the local level through our partnership with local governments. And I'm going to dig into a few of these things in the next few slides. Now, methane is up to 86 times more potent in terms of its ability to warm the planet, its contribution to global warming, than is carbon dioxide. So it's very important for us to take a look at methane. And as you can see from this table, our rural development team is going to be very busy in the next year. The AIR District is in the midst of rural development for a number of sources that produce and contribute to our methane inventory, including organic material handling, which includes transfer stations, chip and grind operations, composting facilities, sewage treatment, which is, of course, a big producer of methane. Hydrogen plants at refineries are a big contributor as well. And, of course, our largest contributor, landfills. So we're taking a regulatory approach, a comprehensive regulatory approach to addressing methane. Now, where we don't have authority to regulate, either because of the type of pollutant or the type of source, we turn to other tools that we have at our disposal. So as you all know, a little over a year ago, we gave out $4.5 million in climate protection grants to local public agencies across the Bay Area. About half of those went to projects that will reduce the use of natural gas in buildings. And as you remember, I just said, that was one of the key priorities in our Clean Air Plan. The other half of the projects, of the grant projects, are focusing on testing out innovations. So that could be emerging technologies like heat pump water heaters, or it could be innovative policy or financial approaches. So an example, as was mentioned earlier, was the policy approach in Marin County of requiring low carbon concrete for all building projects. So that's an example of an innovation through policy. And I just wanted to add to what was mentioned earlier, we are, Air District staff is planning to convene a webinar open to all Bay Area local government staff early in 2020 to feature not just the ordinance, but how might another jurisdiction go about trying to replicate that ordinance. So many of these grants serve to support our other key effort, the Building Decarbonization Program. We're, as was mentioned earlier, we're a member of the Building Decarbonization Coalition, and we're working with them to develop a very comprehensive online clearinghouse of information for local government staff to do the work of policy development, program implementation, to get natural gas out of their buildings. And we recognize that a lot of local government planning staff don't have the expertise or necessarily the time to do all the background research and homework to be able to prepare these kinds of programs or policies. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to sort of streamline their effort and help them out. And then public messaging, outreach, and communication is always a very key component to what we do in the climate program. We try to integrate climate messaging into the Spare the Air program. We partner with MTC on the Youth for Environment and Sustainability, the YES Conference, which I think is happening again in 2020 in the spring. And an area that's a little newer to us is the connection between the impacts on climate change and the decisions about the food that we consume. So a little over a year ago, we convened with the South Bay nonprofit Actera, a region-wide meeting on the connection between climate and food for industry, food industry folks, and we're planning to have another event in 2020. Now, the transportation sector represents the largest share of greenhouse gas emissions in the Air District's Bay Area inventory, and I believe in all of your local community-wide inventories, it's the same story. Our approach at the Air District prioritizes zero-emission vehicles and reducing vehicle travel. Our technology implementation office implements a number of electric vehicle incentive programs, including funding for charging infrastructure as well as vehicles. And there are a couple of these programs, the Clean Cars for All program and the Drive Clean Bay Area program, that are getting at bringing down the cost of electric vehicle ownership. And that's really important for a lot of different reasons. The Clean Cars for All program provides incentives to lower income households specifically, and the Drive Clean Bay Area program has created a region-wide group purchase discount for all Bay Area residents. So those are two very exciting programs. And then the Diesel Free by 33 program is really a perfect integration of the work we're doing to try to reduce the health burden of air pollution on specific communities in the Bay Area and our climate protection program by targeting diesel particulate matter, which also is a source of black carbon. So that's a nice way that we link to priority areas of the Air District. Now, reducing vehicle travel is probably the hardest part of achieving both our clean air and our climate protection goals. And while we do offer funding for some things like bike lanes and facilities and shuttles, a lot of our focus is on changing the land use patterns that require auto dependency. So, for example, through our work to update and implement CEQA thresholds and guidance, the way we work with local governments to review plans and provide feedback, and collaborating with MTC on Plan Bay Area. These are ways that we go about this through land use planning. So moving forward, and I wanted to go back to the earlier studies that I mentioned, because you know these reports that are coming out are really terrifying, and we can feel and hear the concern and the fear when we have conversations about this topic here in the building among staff. We hear it in this room when we hear from members of the public, and we hear it at home from our children, and it's very real. And the only meaningful response that we can take is to double down on our efforts. And I think it's very important to remember that what we do here in the Bay Area matters. We have an example and a leadership that on both clean air and climate protection that drives the rest of the state. And California drives the rest of the country. And it's very important for us to remember that what we do here matters. And as we look forward, it's really scary and challenging, but it's also very exciting. We're going to be coming back to you in 2020 with aggressive strategies, with new ideas for legislation and rulemaking. We're going to integrate our climate protection work with our AB 617 work. We're going to be exploring new ways to engage and empower youth. And we want to continue to support and accelerate, of course, the local action that's really where the greenhouse gas emission reductions occur. And we're going to do this in continued collaboration with our state and our regional and our local government partners. Thank you.
Abby, thank you so much. Sobering start, but I'm glad you end with some hopefulness and just a really thorough presentation. I appreciate all the work that you do here and on down to local level because we see you there as well. So questions, comments, I'm going to start way over here. Director Hurt.
Thank you. I was really fascinated with your meeting the 2020 target slide, and I was curious about the 2001 to 2008 high GHG emissions, and I'm kind of presuming that was during Schwarzenegger, Governor Schwarzenegger's time, and so maybe there's deregulation. What would you attribute to the high emission at that time?
Smarter people here in the room can correct me, but I would actually say that Governor Schwarzenegger was quite a champion of climate protection. Okay. He was the strongest voice up to that time that the state had really had. I think what you're seeing is a bit of economic activity. We were in a boom, and you see a precipitous decline that really coincides with our recession. And I think that probably is a big part of the story.
Okay, thank you. And thank you. Thank you. One more question. I think when I looked at your strategic approach, you know, often the hindrance to local government kind of fulfilling climate action change and getting better about what they're doing is not the will, but the costs. And so I think it's really great, and I support the plan to assist in staff time, because small cities like ourselves, it's very difficult to try to refocus, especially when we don't have the expertise. And I would suggest that maybe a toolkit's created for low-hanging fruit for cities, things that they can just do to implement the things and approaches and plans that you're considering.
And I'm going to just jump in real quickly, Abby, to go back to that slide 6 that the director just referred to. So I'm presuming you're not showing 1990, but I'm presuming if that graph extended to the left, 1990, it would show emissions at 430 MMT. So what was the driver? What drove it up so quickly, so precipitously from 430 MMT in 1990 to four to where it is in 2000. You see what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do we know?
It was largely economic growth, yeah. Chair Rice. I think what you see, as Abby pointed out, you see this precipitous drop at 2008. If you look at the sector GHG graphs, it tells a little bit more of the story. And what you see if you look at transportation is you see this drop in 2008, and then it bottoms out when the economy starts to rise again, and then gasoline consumption goes up. Now, it hasn't gotten quite up to where we were in 2008 because we have a cleaner fleet. If you look at the big picture, though, what's really driving GHG reductions in California is clean energy. We haven't seen the electric grid is cleaning up. We have not seen significant reductions of sources in the refining sector. Those cap-and-trade sources have been fairly flat. But we've seen significant reductions from the energy sector, the electric sector.
Which this board or this regulatory body helped drive with the CCA movement. So, okay. Mm-hmm. Director Barrett.
Thank you. And thank you, Abby. I think this is a pretty good overview. But on slide 11, under the zero carbon vehicles, you point out our Diesel 3 by 33 initiative, and clearly that is more than just electric vehicles. And I really think that, as Director Hurt just mentioned, low-hanging fruit, one of the things we're starting to see with the increase in wildfires and the increase in public safety shutoffs by PG&E is that people are moving to buying and using more personal generators. And I think that the Air District should put into policy something about banning or at least having them absolutely be permitted any kind of personal use of a diesel-generated generator. We need to, that is to me an easy thing to move on. There are other options for generators, and we really need to be proactive on that and not just wait until so many of them have been sold. So thank you.
Director Ross.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the great report and the great work, Abby. So following on Director Barrett's comments about diesel generators and electrification, we're on slide 11. The electric vehicle batteries, usually the cost of a 100-kilowatt battery used to be $11,000. It's gone down to about $1,500 now. And I heard a report that within 5 years, by 2024, actually 4 years, it's going to be $100. Now, what that portends is a great demand and increase for the use of those batteries, which will significantly lower the cost of electric cars, which will significantly increase the demand for charging stations. So while you're thinking of trying to drop a schematic for electrification down the road, I mentioned this at the climate protection meeting, battery storage is going to become incredibly ubiquitous, and the demand will become incredibly strong. Having a compatible system, a set of ordinances, people will be stacking batteries in their homes. They'll be using batteries. The used batteries from cars can still be used for home power storage. We can maybe even look at the electrification of a whole new range of where we're using combustion energy now. Because that price drop is going to be stunning. It's like Moore's Law only applied to batteries. So what we've talked about before is charging stations. When we talk about the electric vehicle charge and clean cars for all, well, by then we're going to have the third and fourth wave of second and third generation sales of electric vehicles. Those Teslas that are going to be 10 and 7 and 9 years old are now going to be very affordable as people move to the cheaper, newer, those who can afford it at the upper income levels. There's going to be a glut suddenly of electric cars. Then there's going to be the cause of equity that the charging stations are only at the rich malls, they're only at the rich, the higher income areas, and where are they in the local neighborhoods for the lower income people who will suddenly want to gravitate towards those to because they're cheaper to operate, obviously. They don't have to. So I really can't stress enough, I can see the demand coming, and we should be prepared to meet that electrification of our transportation, but also with an eye to using those batteries, making sure the connections and the actual systems are compatible and reusable in other areas, and maybe we could guide that. This also brings up a whole host of other issues. Should we be producing them in the Bay Area? Can we create a new job sector creating batteries, a gigafactory here in the Bay Area? What happens when you have that many electric cars? You drop the price of, you drop the demand for gas, you drop the price of gas. Does that give you room to increase taxes to create further electrification when you drop that demand in the gasoline supply, which we've seen Joe in Houston gets sick at the refinery, the prices go up, you know, 3 cents a gallon. So it's very demand sensitive. It's a market that runs on a very thin margin. So you drop you drop demand 5%, just like you would if you drop water consumption 5 or 7%. It's going to have an interesting effect on the refinery's profitability, and then you're going to have the problem that they had in Germany, where they solar powered everything, all these houses. Then the cost of coal dropped. Then suddenly it started to get used more because it was so cheap. I fear, you know, we have to figure out what's going to happen when the price of gas drops because of electrification demand and the reduced demand for gasoline. How do you make it not as attractive? So I think I've said enough. Thank
you. Director Ross had his Wheaties this morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Director Hudson.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I missed half that. Can you repeat? No. Can you go to slide 6 first, Abby, and then I'm going to ask you to go to 8 in a minute. And I'll try and do... I'm looking at this graph, and a lot of the questions have been asked. The 2020 limit you have there is 431. If you go back to the scoping plan, it was actually 427, so you're in the ballpark. And I thought it got reduced to 396 almost immediately because, as you go back and look at the graph, 2005, the executive order from Schwarzenegger, 2006, AB 32, and 2008, the SB 375, and the scoping plan. And you look at that scoping plan, you cannot minimize the work this air district did with Carl Moyer, et cetera, and the port. I mean, I think the port was a big part of this. Now, if you'd go to 8, and what has always caught my attention, and I probably haven't bugged you recently, but now that I see this, I'm coming back. I ask, what part of the responsibility, that 396 or 427, is the Bay Area's? And you saw we were pretty constant right around 80, 81, 82 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. But I'm seeing here 94, and that has me a little bit concerned, because when you look at the drop, the percentage we're asked to drop below 2020, we should probably be looking at what is just our responsibility. And going from 80 down to 60 or 48, depending on how you're doing it and extrapolating population increase, it didn't seem impossible. But if we got to go from 94 down to 60 or 48, I'm a little concerned that there's, I don't know how fast we're going to have to move to try and get that, but it's going to be a lot more than what we've been doing, and it almost seems impossible. I always look at it as we were trying to get to 10 million metric tons per capita and try to get down to 6 in what we've been doing, and maybe even easier to look at it that way. And scary as this sounds, because Mark and I will be giving a report on this tomorrow night at the mayor's conference, he may have understated the problem. I mean, we really have been talking about 2.5% electric vehicles going to 90 in 2040 or 2050 by legislation. And I don't know. I mean, you can't build these charging stations in there fast enough. I know I always talk about United Airlines, and I walk through their parking structure. Every time I go, every single charging unit is in use, and every third car I walk by is electric in a 10-story parking structure. So Yeah, I think a lot of things are going to change pretty quick in this decade or this coming decade, and a lot of what Mark's saying is right there. We've already seen where cars, in an emergency, will be powering the house for a couple days.
Director Sinks.
Thank you. Well, I'm certainly excited by our efforts to curb methane. You know, we know we have leakage issues. We know we have a landfill methane from landfills and other sources. We know we have an opportunity with electrification of buildings and new construction. Many cities are appropriately, in my view, taking action to make it easier as we go about our, you know, our large energy supplies to be able to taper that down without having to affect our building, our new building stock. So those are great things. But the one really challenging bit about this and the largest component is transportation. And I wonder, since we launched our effort to become diesel-free by 33, how do we know if we're on track? What milestones have we established and are we tracking? And could the board be receiving regular reports? And if we're not there, could we be considering amping up our efforts? I'm wondering also in our efforts in working with the state, since right we're largely talking about a mobile source problem, what more we could be doing to be advocating in the legislature to meet this aspirational goal.
So on the Diesel Free by 33 program, we are giving regular updates to our mobile source committee. How we are tracking the commitments and tracking the vehicle fleet, we're using a couple of different mechanisms. We're using ARB's MFAC model. We are also tracking the number of electric vehicles that are sold in the region monthly. We are doing the same thing on the heavy-duty vehicle side. We are producing regular reviews of the technology that we publish to our website and supply to the partners who signed up for this so that they're aware of the most recent advances and what's available to them in terms of the electric vehicles themselves. This year, we are working with the folks who signed up for this initiative on how we're going to report and track and use the mechanisms that many of the city fleets that are already signed up to this thing use themselves to do reporting. So there's kind of a comprehensive effort there. And as I said, we are checking back regularly with the mobile source committee on it. Some of the other things that we're doing, we're also through our AB617 program and through our regular just regulatory and legislative outreach, we are putting pressure on the Air Resources Board to adopt new regulations to reduce emissions from mobile sources, specifically heavy-duty vehicles, which are a significant component of the program. ARB has committed to us through a rule development schedule that, you know, there are zero emission vehicles, heavy duty vehicle regulations coming for class 4, 5, and 6 trucks. They have already adopted the one for transit fleets, bus fleets. So we are continuing to monitor and put pressure to make sure that this is happening. And, you know, we're still bullish on our targets. We think that a lot of the fleet, because of this reduction in battery price, can go to zero and probably well before the dates that we've been talking about. But that doesn't mean there are sectors that still don't need to be addressed. So in response, we're monitoring, we're working, we're putting as much pressure as we can. You saw on the slide, the last slide that Abby presented, that we're also thinking about kind of new and innovative strategies that we can do around this to go harder and faster at this. And we hope to be able to talk to you a little bit more about them at our retreat as we come forward.
Well, I just have to really appreciate our efforts because, you know, it's been said on climate that leadership is essential, or leadership is important, and followership is essential, right? So if we take our efforts, our technology office, and, you know, the innovation and policy and incentives that we bring to this party, and I think there are other places in the country and in the world that are hungry for demonstrations of feasibility, and we can multiply our effect with our leadership. So thank you very much. Thank you, Abby.
Director Chavez.
Thank you. Thank you for the, I don't know, bringing us down, but in a good way, focusing us. I had a couple of recommendations. One of them that I'm concerned about is that we, all of us, have spent a lot of time trying to look at how we build in reverse commutes, you know, how we're working through land use and planning, and I think it is glacial. And by the time we complete it, there will be no glaciers. And so I want to promote a couple of ideas that I'd really be interested in you all giving some thought and helping me think a little bit more about, all of us. But partly because of my background in the labor movement, for many years I have helped folks negotiate contracts. And one of the issues that comes up quite often is the effectiveness of having people work remotely. And I think there are lots of studies that are kind of all over the map, but there's no collection that would clearly help employers make determinations under what terms and conditions it makes sense to have remote work, 410s, or other strategies that significantly reduce even customers coming to them. So, for example, all of our cities and counties have planning desks that we make people come to us, sometimes for things that really should be accessible online. So I'm really interested in us taking a look at the TDM framework and looking at much more exacting short-term opportunities to directly reduce the need for people to be in their cars quite so much. So that's like one body I'd be interested in getting your thoughts on, because I think it's actually something we can do relatively quickly in a much more cost-effective way than some of the other strategies that we're asking ourselves and our partners to look at. And I think this is particularly true if we look at all large employers, including governmental employers. And then as it relates to schools, one thing that I was thinking a lot about is we all see when the school season ends, because you can drive even more rapidly in the morning where you're going. And it occurs to me that we have not built in incentives for schools, financial incentives for schools to get children to walk. And I think my observation, when the schools got resources for children once they identified them as being foster youth or homeless, I couldn't get better data from the schools. 2 years ago, I couldn't get it. So I think that if there's a cash incentive for them, and again, I don't think it has to be a lot. Every school looks for, I mean, we all fundraise for our schools. It's not I don't think it would have to be significant. And then lastly, I'd be very interested in better understanding in our partnership with MTC how to look at strategic subsidies for more frequent bus availability. We know that in all of our communities that the more frequent a system is, the higher the ridership. That's like the least controversial thing I think you can say about transit. But it occurs to me that if we really want to get people to use the frequent services, that instead of just subsidizing usage, I mean subsidizing the cost of it, the actual subsidy for the frequency may make more sense in terms of driving ridership. And again, I think these can be strategic investments, so they're not all encompassing, but ones that we can actually test and test relatively quickly. Thank you.
Second.
Yeah.
Third.
Yeah.
Director Jones.
Thanks for the presentation. I do think a lot of what we can do here and what we have done is sort of complementing what's happening at the state level. And I think, Abby, you sort of understate one of the major state goals here, which is electrifying transportation. I mean, you mentioned vehicle standards, but really it goes well beyond that. In fact, getting back to Rod's point about GHGs from transportation, 40% from transportation, but if you include the refining of fuels that serve transportation, it's over 50%. And the AB 32 scoping plan adopted by the Air Resources Board specifically identifies the need for regulations and policies to develop clean technologies, especially clean transportation. So I think a lot of what we can do is help. I think several folks have talked about charging. Jack, I think you mentioned, I mean, we're working at ARB at a rule to have electric trucks by 2029. There was a rule passed last year to require every single new public transit bus purchased in this state in 2029 going forward to be zero emission. Tomorrow, the Air Board's having a hearing in Oakland about requiring more ships to plug in to shore power. Already 80% of the ships that come into Oakland plug into shore power. It expands this further around the state. There's, you know, rules looking at other technologies with off-road engines, including garden equipment and things like that. So I think that the challenge is also, as several folks here have talked about, the charging infrastructure and the availability. I have no doubt that there's, in 20 years from now, there's going to be we can make predictions, but there's going to be an amazingly large number of electric vehicles on the road that are going to that beyond the capacity of what we have today on charging. And so, and while there's the Volkswagen settlement money and some PUC money and some cap and trade money, I think we have a long ways to go for new charging. And I think that's an area where we can complement. The rules are happening at the state level. In fact, Damien, you said put pressure. Actually, all of these strategies are identified in the adopted scoping plan, and it's great when the Air District, it's about pushing them as fast as possible, right? And getting the support letters from the Air District when these rules are being developed is always really helpful. And so I do think, though, that is also making this transition, how do I say, getting to this just transition and dealing with equity issues and environmental justice issues, because I think in the Bay Area, with a lot of low-income communities, including communities that I represent, that the need to provide grants and subsidies to more communities so that our communities are all able to equally share in this new technology. I think that's the challenge, and I think that's something that we can really focus on in the Bay Area because we care about that, right? Is how do we have more of our funding go to ensure that low-income communities are equally accessing all the electric vehicle technology, Jack, like the grant program that equalizes sort of the purchasing around the Bay Area. I think that's the kind of stuff we can really help on, because the regulations statewide are happening. It's how do we help sort of implement them on a faster level. I mean, we got pushback from the transit agencies on the rule, and many of us serve on transit agencies in our local capacities and push back on how clear. Your point, I exactly agree about how do we have focused transportation investments. There are joint meetings happening now between the Air Resources Board and the California Transportation Commission to try to look at, and I think that needs to happen, as you say here with MTC, how does the transportation money get invested to complement the air quality goals? So far, I think changing the culture at the Transportation Commission has not been easy, right? They're still different, you know, if you've gone to those meetings, you've seen those discussions, but I think here in the Bay Area, we have more of an ability to do that, to get transportation to focus investments to achieve the air quality goals. And maybe this is worth of a discussion at the Bay Area Regional Collaborative, which I think you chair now, is a discussion about how regional monies can be aligned and having a discussion at BARC about how MTC and Air District work together to align funding, and maybe that's sort of a great way to implement what you just talked about.
Director Ness.
Thank you, Abby. This was terrific and brings up all kinds of ideas and thoughts and so forth. So I think I'd have to agree with just about everyone, but Director Ross, you did a great job of talking about the EVs. So let me start there, but you said a great deal of what I might have said about the charging stations and so forth. One of the things we haven't talked about is bikes. We are, you know, we are not only a bike-friendly city, we're a bike-challenged city at this point, and there's a lot of discussion about
how do you drive when how do you drive at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning when all the kids are going to school, and should the bike stop at stop signs and so forth? One of the discussions we had last night. But let me just add some color to the EVs. So I went online while the rest of you were chatting and looked at what I could buy. Yeah. You can buy some pretty cheap EVs. They have a very short range. So I happened to be in a Bolt last night with a B. They have a terrific range.
Yeah.
Do you have one?
I do, 250 miles.
Yeah. Yeah, terrific range. And they're not cheap, by the way. And that's one of the issues. So as I looked at the EVs, when they start to get cheaper, they have a shorter range. But you could get a Land Rover, and that has a range of about 32 miles. So what's called an electric car is sort of all over the place. The Land Rover is $80,000, by the way, if you'd like one. So, but I had a conversation this morning with my daughter, whose daughter is going off to college. And I said, oh, perfect. This is the time for her to buy an EV. Oh, she said, no, Mom. She's so worried about the charging stations. Will there be a charging station on campus? What will she do? Suppose she can't get home. How far away will it be? And I thought that really starts to color the whole thing. And probably we need to really look at doing primarily supercharging stations in any event. But I don't think we've gotten serious enough about charging stations in our cities as well. We don't have a particular goal in Palo Alto for the number of charging stations. Sort of like when there's some money left over, we put some more charging stations in. So I think cities certainly could look at that at that as one of their priorities, because it makes a huge difference if you know where there's a charging station. But just what Director Hudson said, all of a sudden you get to a garage and all the EV stations are filled. And then what do you do? So a gas station is pretty easy to find. It's much harder to find an EV station, especially if you need to be hooked up for a good half hour or so. So my message would be, for us to really get serious about this, we've really got to get serious about the charging stations. You know, just as you can't imagine going more than a mile or two in this county without a gas station around, where are the EVs going to be? So I hope we'll concentrate more on that. And I think I had a recent letter that talked about super EVs going in San Jose, am I right? Near the new Google complex?
That's correct.
They'll be renaming San Jose pretty soon.
Yeah, there are some of the superchargers, and by super we mean over 150 kilowatts an hour. So they're some pretty powerful new innovations that are in the 150 kilowatt, 350 kilowatt per hour range, right? So what does that mean? Our current charging stations are operating somewhere in the 20 to 30 kilowatts, depending on which ones you use, right? Tesla or other ones. So this could reduce the charging time quite significantly for a lot of EVs. The conversation is around 150 miles of range in 5 minutes. So,
and that's where we need to go. Otherwise, yeah. It's like stopping at a gas station now and them saying, you can have 2 gallons, but that's all we can give you. Because that's a reasonable comparison, I think. So, as I said, that's my message, and I certainly underscore what Director Ross said this morning. Thanks.
Director Zhu.
Thank you, Ms. Young, for the great presentation. Your comment about your daughter going to college just reminded me, like, it's interesting that the question we have to ask ourselves is, like, is there enough charging? And I remember going to college. Yeah, you need a car. You feel like you need a car in order to get everywhere. And, you know, I had the fortune of going to UC Davis for my undergrad. And the most amazing thing was that I didn't need a car. And it was the most amazing experience because I could bike everywhere, and I could bike freely because there were protected lanes. And, like, I never even had to have that question postulated. And what an amazing gift that would be if, like, we didn't have to ask that question. It's like, is there charging? It's like, can I get from point A to point B in a even more sustainable manner, and like biking or walking or taking public transit? So I just put that out there, and it just brought me back to college, but a long time ago. And I did want to comment on kind of the reductions that we've seen, and Mr. Nudd accurately pointed out, you know, the reason why we saw the reduction from that period of time within the state was primarily for the cleanup of our electricity sector, our energy sector. And even more importantly is from that time period, you know, a couple things happened. And one was that the state actually set renewable energy targets in 2002 saying, hey, by 2017, 20% of your electricity mix has to come from renewable sources. So it pushed all the utilities to go out there and procure energy. 2015, we updated that to 50% by 2030. So it was the gravity that led to the decrease in emissions. We saw a subsequent decrease in emissions also due to in our transportation sector actually during that time. And I think, and Director Joya can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of that was driven by the fuel efficiency rules and the purchase of greater fuel efficiency vehicles on the road. But we're starting to see that kind of tick back up in the other direction, right? It makes up a larger percentage of our emissions portfolio, and it's moving in the wrong direction. And I think we have to think a little bit bigger that, you know, population has also grown during that period in time. And the thought that electrification of vehicles, while it definitely needs to be one important strategy and should be something we continue pushing forward with, it's not going to be enough. Just given the rate of growth of population within the state. And this is why we're already starting to see that increase, right? Because you get the savings in the fuel efficiency, you'll get the savings from the electric vehicles, and then you'll end up with congestion on the roads like we have today. And that's an even bigger problem, right? Because we're not going to make our roads any wider. There's no more space to do that, nor should we be even thinking about that. And so I think the intention of how we started to look at our grant programs and starting to focus on incentivizing, you know, bike infrastructure and other kind of alternative modes, and they shouldn't be alternative, but alternative modes, sustainable modes of transportation, that's kind of the direction we need to be doing and more aggressively pushing if we're going to make a kind of a dramatic difference on the transportation side. And I really appreciated the comments from Director Chavez on kind of the remote connectivity of workers to their workplace, which brings in the exact question around infill and density and sustainable-oriented transit development within the state. And we're going to have to step up in an air district if we're going to hit our state goals, too, in terms of taking positions on all of these states, because this is one of the major issues we're grappling with all across the state, right? Kind of this issue around housing and affordable housing. And I think that's going to be an area we're going to have to play not just a coordination role with, you know, Plan Bay Area and MTC, obviously, but we may have to step up even a little bit more like we have in other areas to push for, you know, these things that we know are going to have an impact on greenhouse gas emissions, which is increased density around kind of with a sustainable transit planning development in mind. And I would say that the last two points I want to make is for the key priorities. You know, we talk about it all the time, and we're doing so much work around making sure we're focusing on our disadvantaged communities and a focus on equity. That should be a priority also. And that should just be, we should list that proudly as a priority because we are doing that, and we should be continuing to put that forward as one of our key areas of why we do the work we do. And the last thing I would love to kind of just see the next time we get the presentation or as you go back to the Climate Protection Committee is it was a major accomplishment by this air district to adopt the 2017 climate plan. Like, we should all be very proud of the work that staff did working with stakeholders and this board did in terms of approving that kind of historic document. And I think what we're missing a little bit is we have the priorities of the different things you're working on, but they're not driven by any milestones or targets. And I know some of that's a little difficult to kind of quantify, but we kind of have to treat it like a project, right? If the urgency, as we're talking about, is there, mm-hmm. and the goal is there to get to 2050, well, we've set a target there. If we set a diesel-free by 2033, we set a target there so that we have to march towards that. And I think in order to figure out how all of these different pieces kind of fit in the puzzle and why they're more important and how quickly we're moving forward on stuff, and maybe we should move more quickly on certain things, there has to be some kind of dates on when things are going to happen, and then we'll have the question of, like, is it fast enough and why, or are there additional resources you need to implement things, or should we be focusing on other areas? But thank you.
And how much progress have we made in terms of meeting those goals? Yeah. Director Cutter.
Hi, thank you. One of the benefits of going last is you get to comment on everybody's comments and so forth. But just bringing up on Tyrone's about giving transit agencies right now give money or are doing projects like the in Alameda County, the East 14th Corridor or the San Pablo Corridor. And if you could actually give matching funds to these things where cities could partake in getting some matching funds, so that's the incentive to cities to also be part of this whole project. There are a lot of different areas we could put bike lanes in. I mean, just thinking, it's kind of one of the things we all want to do, but one of the things that's last on the budget in our city is trying to put those bike lanes in because they are so expensive. So perhaps if you made the incentive of matching funds with it, that's something that we could then, you know, sell a little bit better. So that was one. And then the other was I just had an occasion to go to Waste Management's facilities in San Leandro, and they put a new MRF in, which we're not supposed to publicize too much, but it was a 15, I think, altogether $30 million investment. And what it is it takes the organics out of regular garbage. So you're supposed to separate your garbage from organics and not. But then they do this one last haul through and separate the organics from the garbage that is existing. And you don't want your community to hear that so much because then everybody dumps everything in the same garbage can. But those are the kind of projects that will get you where you want to be with the methane gas in the landfill and so forth. And I just think those are really important because Waste Management actually is a pretty good model for not only Northern California, but through the United States, people visit over there. And just trying to get some different strategies for those kinds of things, I think would go a long way for helping with that kind of a gas. That's it.
Director Walton, you have something?
Thank you so much, Chair Rice, and thank you so much for the report, Ms. Young. Just a couple of things as we talk about charging stations, and it's not just location as well as we think about this, because there's also the fact that these manufacturers are making all these different types of plugs.
Yes.
And different types of stations, which doesn't help us as policymakers mm-hmm. Ensure equitable opportunities for people to purchase electric vehicles and be able to have adequate charging stations, not just across the Bay Area, but across the state and across the country. So I think we should also be thinking about that and making that push. Wasn't going to touch on that, but that's just something that always comes up. But I was looking at slide 11, the Clean Cars for All grants for low-income households. And about 2 months ago, we were in Stockholm in London, looking at their congestion pricing models and what they're doing. And one of the things that occurred to me in both cities is that they didn't really, their thought process was that their low-income communities were not driving. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't make allowances for obviously making sure that communities of color, low-income communities, weren't necessarily affected. And so as I look at, and that's not the case in the communities that I serve. Our low-income families are driving all the time, consistently, and they're driving cars that emit a lot of gas, et cetera, because they are cheaper, even though we do have electric vehicles that are becoming more reasonable, but you can't get very far in some of those. But I was just interested in hearing a little bit more about how the Clean Cars for All grants for low-income households is working.
So we launched that. We had a soft launch of the program this summer. We've about, at this point, $10 million in the program itself, and the funds are available Bay Area-wide. When we initially started, they were restricted to our highly impacted communities. So far, we've spent about $1.3 million. We have testimonial after testimonial online from folks who are supremely happy with their vehicles. And what folks are buying mostly is actually We were kind of surprised by this. They're buying plug-in hybrids and full battery electric vehicles. We thought it would be more a mix of plug-in hybrids and hybrid vehicles. What a lot of the folks are most happy about is the grant is actually able to come in many cases pay for the majority of the cost of the vehicle for them. So grants for folks with low income can be up to, I think it's $9,000, and that pays for the entire cost of some of these vehicles for the folks who are buying them. But the main thing that we hear, and the majority of, in the testimonial, practically everyone says, you know, the reduction in cost on what I was spending on gasoline is a huge factor in the purchase. So the program's working well. Is it as big or is it moving as fast as we need to go to meet our climate goals? The answer is no, but we're off to a good start. So much so the state has actually asked us if we want to apply for an additional $10 million in funding. And we asked them what was available. They said 15, so we went for the entire 15. We'll see whether we get it or not, but our intention is to double down on this program.
Thank you. Cool.
Director Sparing.
Thank you, and thank you for the report. You know, I think there ought to be more discussion about some of the preventative actions that we can take. You know, when I look at the forest fires we have, and you look at how the forests were managed, you know, 50, 40 years ago, it was much different. You know, they cleared a lot of the fuel that's on the floor of the forest. They had large fire breaks. I mean, they did a lot of things to prevent what you're seeing today. But because of the environmental movement, a lot of that has gone away, and now we've got these fires, and now it's kind of a cycle that we're in. And so that's one thing that needs to be looked at. Another is that has to be tackled is this job-housing balance. You know, you have all this congestion, and we have all this clean air, but you know, I don't think Santa Clara wants to share any of their jobs with Solano County. And so when it comes down to that type of movement, all of a sudden it's, oh, wait a minute. And so, yeah, I think there needs to be some discussion about that. And, you know, as we continue to grow, we need to start talking about where do we want these industries and where do we want these jobs if we're going to have a healthy Bay Area. The other thing we need to talk about is why is public transit not being used? Why is it down? And, you know, it seems like we're afraid to criticize, you know, like BART. I mean, that's just a miserable, dirty thing to ride today. You know, I mean, I'll just use some of my experiences with, you know, there's homeless people on the trains. They're taking up four seats. I mean, it's a bad odor. I mean, the list goes on and on. And it's driving people out of that. And it's not a good experience. And so if we want people in public transit, we better make it a good experience. But we don't want, you know, we caution away from that. It's our low-income wage earners, you know, they have to drive, but and they are punished the most. $7 bridge tolls, you know, gas is $4, the cost of the car. And then you wonder, why aren't they driving an electric car? The reason why they're not driving is they're on survival mode, and we really need to focus a little bit more as to why these people are driving, and then what can we do to help facilitate that and, you know, to help with the environment. And so I think that's something that we really have to talk about. And another is why aren't we talking about working hours? Why aren't we talking about certain industries? You don't work from 9 to 5. You know, really start talking about shifting those hours to help with the congestion. You know, I've been coming down here a long time, and when we went to Santa Clara down to the committee, it took me 3 hours from Solano County to get there and 3 hours to get back. I mean, and that, so nobody's going to tell me congestion's getting better because it's not. And, you know, if you really want to solve all these problems, destroy the economy. That's the quickest way to do it. You look at these spikes and you know, people say, well, why is it spiking like that? Every one of those spikes is a jump or an actual a shift in the economy. And so we need to find a way. How do we balance these economic swings with some of the things that we're trying to achieve? And the last thing I want to say is that I wish we weren't so gloom and doom the way we present this. you know, not just this air district, but I look at the work that MTC's done, we have really set a foundation for the next generation to build on and to improve and to kind of present it like it's just been a massive failure. I think it's a mistake. You know, I know, like my grandson, I tell him that, you know, we're building a foundation that you can do great things in the future to really improve the environment and make this a much better country to live in. And so I would just hope that, you know, our kids aren't being told that, you know, this generation has really destroyed the planet. And, you know, we're doing a lot of things to correct things that have been done in the past. And I think there's been a lot of improvements, and the technology is changing so fast that 20 years from now, none of us are going to recognize many of the things that we see today. And so I just would like to have a little bit more positive touch on, you know, the great things we've done, but there's great things still left to do.
Okay, I'm going to go to the birthday boy because he was asleep at the wheel over there in the first go-round.
I thought
and then we're
that
go
she
to,
was
and then
just answering
comments.
Questions. Yeah, I thought we were just asking questions
no, okay.
The first time. So
it's kind of has grown.
It's hard to follow Mr. Spearing seriously now. Okay, Boomer, yeah. That's what I was. Everyone's waiting for it, right? We're going to have a beer to talk about some of that stuff because I don't know that I agree with all of it. But I had three things that I wanted to raise. The first is I'll pick up with the land use item, which I really strongly agree with, and the need to have stronger regional collaboration. We have Spare the Air Days. It's an existing community outreach program, and I know the legislative committee has heard me say this. I don't get the point of them. They don't do anything. I'm pretty critical of Spare the Air Days because if you want to change people's behavior, you have to give them meaningful choices. And I feel like an education campaign is kind of a window dressing. And what we really should be doing is looking at how do we make people critically evaluate their current behavior. And that's for all generations of people, I think. And so for me, I think of things like why aren't we collaborating with, and the MTC folks here are going to shudder a little bit, why aren't we having additional tolls on Spare the Air Days that are used to subsidize and improve the quality and cleanliness of transit for people so that people have a meaningful choice on those days? So I would really like to see us spend more time with existing programs we have and make them programs that make people think critically, because I don't think they succeed in that respect. Second, also following off of Mr. Spearing and his very long drive to Milpitas, I had a similar but different experience being a carless person, taking BART to Warm Springs and then running a 10K. As those who were at Station Resource Committee that day knew, ran a 10K to Milpitas City Hall and was almost kicked out by security because they probably thought I was a crazy person when I ran in. But I think it comes back to an important question, which is, where are the gaps, and this isn't a transit service issue, but where are the gaps in how we incentivize people to make choices? Because I think if people were given, this goes back to my earlier point a little bit, if we give people different things to think about and we incentivize different behavior, then people will start to demand changes in the infrastructure when they see that those deficiencies exist. And so something I thought about is, I thought it was kind of ironic that, you know, and Mr. Hudson and I have talked about this a couple times, but we have a cost reimbursement program. So every time any person here drives and you drive from Napa or Solano or any other county, you know, to another place, we reimburse you the federal mileage. I don't get anything for biking or walking to these meetings and being completely carbon neutral. And I think that's a bad incentive program. And I think that we think of it, we can take it as, well, this is intended to be reimbursement, but it's really like, let's think about a proactive approach, which is, why don't we do things like I did with my employer, which was say, you know what, you pay for parking up to $200 a month for parking for each of these employees who work here. I bicycle to work. It costs $165 a year for my bike, Ford Go bike membership. Maybe you should pay that in lieu of $200 a month that I could just take for a parking garage. And why aren't we giving that to people? Why aren't we drafting a policy that employers, public agencies, and private employers could be using to incentivize, hey, you get $200 a month, but instead of your parking, it covers your annual membership and your gym membership per month. so that we're promoting healthy lifestyles, healthy behavior, and we're giving people the personal time and space to actually be equipped to walk or bike to work or do something that's healthy for them and their community. And then I think my last item is back onto something Director Ju said about active transit. And I know Director Nist kind of kicked it off, but I really... And apologies to Directors Cutter and Haggerty, who hear me at the Alameda County Transportation Commission all the time. I'm a huge proponent of active transit, and I'm going to be a bit of a turd in the punch bowl when I say this, but electric cars don't solve anything. And I'm going to be unpopular for saying that. We talk all about these EV charging stations. They will solve nothing for us, because if you are in traffic, you are part of the traffic. And unless you are moving everything, and I know that we're talking this long-term migration away from gasoline and diesel-powered vehicles, but unless you're moving all that off the road, the traffic that exists by congestion from cars is going to continue to pollute the air. And so we need to create alternative spaces for people who want to actually create and preserve clean air by the way they choose to transport themselves. And so I'm making a commitment. I was going to do it today for my 40th birthday, but the weather did not cooperate. So I'm going to bike 50 miles from Emeryville to this meeting at the first meeting where we don't have bad weather, just to make a point that you can do that, and that we should finish the bike bridge on the Western Span so that people from my generation or younger than me and people who are at this table, because I don't believe it's an ageist thing. Like people, I know 70, 80-year-old people in my community who bike. We should make it possible for people to have those choices, and that just takes political willpower and reprioritizing our finances.
All right.
Madam Chair, I just need clarification. Is he going to buy the beer or am I?
If it's his birthday, you're buying.
Big money.
We'll Rochambeau.
Have two beers. Okay. Public speakers.
Jed Holtzman.
Jed, thank you for waiting, Jed. I thought you'd want to hear all that.
That's why we're here. Thank you very much, Directors. Jed Holtzman, 350 Bay Area, and thanks to Ms. Young for the presentation. I'm not sure of the exact amount at this point, but we represent somewhere in the 20,000-ish range of Bay Area citizens in all of your communities who are counting on me to be here and advocate for the things I'm advocating for. The discussion was really great, and I would like to comment on all of it, but I don't have enough time. The COP25 process, the international process, folks are rightfully derisive about the talk that's been going on for 25 years. People don't respect that. People respect leadership, and you can see the action that Berkeley took to ban natural gas has spread like a spread like gangbusters to the Pacific Northwest and now to the East Coast, setting, I'm sorry, there aren't better metaphors, embers there that are going to basically spread in those areas. That is in just a matter of a couple months. That shows that there was basically a reservoir of desire for action waiting to be unmoored that kind of we're always pushing agencies like this to take advantage of. The percent reductions of GHGs per year that would be required to meet your climate target is unknown, but gargantuan, and we are nowhere on that, just to let you know. You're talking about targets and plans. We are nowhere on the percent reductions per year that would be required to get to the 2030 or 2050 climate targets. Ms. Young, if you would help me out and go to slide 2, I want to highlight the executive director of the United Nations Environment Program said, we need to catch up on the years in which we procrastinated. That's the tiny quote in the fine print. That includes at the Air District. We have known about this we've known about this problem for a very long time. The Air District has had a climate program since 2008. In order to get to the percent reductions per year that are required, we need to catch up on the years in which we procrastinated, which means that probably what we are advocating for is not enough. And a lot of the discussion that has happened today really elucidates that. If you could go to slide 3, please. Global GHG emissions must fall by 7.6% each year through 2030 in order to meet the climate target. If you wait longer, you will need more than that. 10% reductions per year, 20% per year, that is starting to get too impossible, like Director Hudson said. So we have to do this for our survival. Ms. Young didn't mention food security and water security as basic downer things that are going to be in major peril. And without food and water, we aren't getting very far. If you could please go to slide 7. A lot of these priorities are going to involve other folks. You're really going to need to become experts in implementation at other agencies. And lastly, if you could go to slide 8, and I'm sorry for the extra 30 seconds. This graph already indicates the GHGs being transformed by how powerful they are. Methane is more powerful, but even given that, it's 10% of the problem. If we were to entirely eliminate methane and F-gas emissions, which we are not looking at, you would still have 82% of the problem. We are not even talking about how we're going to get to that 82%, except insofar as other agencies largely are going to need to do that. And so again, this air district must become experts at advocacy and getting the folks who can actually reduce that CO2 to greatly increase their ambition. And any rules that you look at take at least a year to develop and many years to implement. And as you've heard, we really don't have time for that timeline. And so when we come and say in 2020 we need to see 5, 10 GHG-related rules, that's not crazy. That's actually borne out by the facts. Thank you for the extra time.
You're welcome. Okay. Any closing comments from staff on this item? Abby, you want to speak to anything that you heard?
I heard a lot. I'd like to sort of piggyback on what Jed said about this, or maybe it was the other slide, the one before, that these are really important priorities, but we cannot do this by ourselves. And I think that that's the biggest takeaway, that this the collaboration and the partnership to do meaningful things, things that are really going to move the needle, is so critical. And so you're going to be hearing a lot more from us in your city councils as we support the work that you're doing. And we're really trying to have more of a back and forth with our local agency partners to hone in on what it is that we can do and the role we can play to really accelerate these actions.
Okay. All right. Well, I will just kind of close, I think, wrap up a little bit. I did lots of thoughts and ideas came out, and the point around our climate plan, our clean air plan relies on the cooperation and muscle and desire of so many other entities at the jurisdiction, at the local level, but also all the way up. But that doesn't mean that we don't use what resources we have here and leverage we have here to drive. So, and as an air district, we have a regulatory arm, and we need to pull on that, use that muscle as much as possible. But it only can go so far, and only in so many ways. We also have an incentive muscle, and we heard a lot about how do we use those incentive dollars that we have to drive the change that needs to happen or to accelerate adoption. And then we also have, I think, another arm, it's a little bit in terms of getting out into those communities, but we have a resource arm that is a lot of expertise and data analysis, and I think that is a muscle we also can use and share and help to drive regulation, drive behavior change in the way it needs to go. The only item I didn't hear brought up around ideas around maybe how we can use one of those muscles, and that being the incentive muscle, is when we're talking, and this is around the diesel free by 33 and that transportation sector attributed to heavy duty vehicles and truck hauling, truck fleets, is that we want to make sure, I think, that our incentive programs are really aligning with the CARB rules as they come down heavier in that transition. And I don't know that we ever talk about actual charging grid for heavy-duty vehicles. And I think that's something we may need to look into to really marry up, because it's not just getting the vehicle, it's about having the confidence. And frankly, if you think about it, with the weigh stations and things like that, you actually have footprint exactly in the travel patterns where those vehicles are going with which to support charging. So anyway, that's the only thought I had.
When I'm listening to all the comments, I too am struck by all the conversation we had today. But one thing I think the board may not necessarily remember is we do have a commuter benefits program.
Yes, I was going to mention it.
This is one in which it's targeted towards employees, I believe, of 50 or more, if I recall. This is something we did in partnership with MTC. And I believe it was Director Ross, when you were chair, where you went up to Sacramento and they first said no to us. And we turned them around the next year when Director Hill, Jerry Hill, was our chair. That being said, I think it's probably time for me to do a check-in back with the board about where it is. And maybe we could use that as a platform to build upon on some of the ideas that you all have talked about here today. I've heard about work hours. I've heard a lot about how do we further take steps to address what levers do we have in terms of helping in terms of congestion. That might be one that you all might want to think about.
But I think Director Bowder's point also was that we have all of our institutions, and we have grown up in a car culture, and there's some things there's these very subtle signals being, not so subtle actually, but signals being sent all the time that reinforce it's okay to drive. And frankly, on our sheet, maybe we shouldn't be getting that mileage reimbursement, and it should be noted. No, this is a debit, not a credit, as you check off, did you carpool, did you? I think that's more, it's about looking through the lens of how many things do we do, how are our systems set up that actually support, encourage the car culture. So
I did want to, Madam Chair, I heard that point earlier, and so we took that back as a suggestion by staff. We have changed it so that you can get $3 reimbursement for walking, by the way. So that is something we put in place, just putting it in place. But
per mile?
No. So it's per meeting, and so that's what the employees get, Director Bowders. And so
I want to thank you for that, because that seems like an insignificant thing, but I will tell you, I take little victories any day, and that is very meaningful. So thank you for that.
Well, we can build upon it, right? That's the idea. I did want to let you know that we did take that step.
All right. Okay, well, Abby, thank you for your work again and for the presentation and great conversation. And one of the beauties of these regional boards we sit in is we get to hear not only what staff presents and what we learn here, but we learn from each other and can take things back to our jurisdiction. So I think that was happening today. So now, board member comments, anything unrelated or related to what's going on here? And I'll start with Director Sparing.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to remind everyone to please get your evaluation forms in to us so we can stop bugging you. And if you're not going to submit one, just shoot us an email and say we're not submitting, just so, and we'll check you off.
Yeah. Vanessa, can you shoot us all an email to put that at the top, a reminder at the top of our email piles? Thanks. Director Hudson.
Yeah, probably should have talked to this on the previous one, but it was getting lengthy. I find it amazing that John Joyer brought up the point that we're going to have trucks electrified by 2029, by 2040. I don't think the state wants to sell anything more than electric cars. So when are we going to electrify the port? I mean, it was one of the early discrete actions in the 2008 scoping plan, and it should have been done by now. Anybody that's been on a cruise and you pull out a port, that is just, I mean, you actually paid for this. The second thing, a lot of these discussions we had today, transit, reverse commutes, working at home, are hopefully being solved in what we're trying to do with the MaaS platform, the mobility as a service. And it might be wise to at least throw that into the TIO organization to see how that is coming along. I know that CCTA just got $8.8 million towards working for that, and I see what's being done in Europe and a lot of advances. Third thing is, it talked about how are we educating people. I will tell you that a month or two ago, the Air District held a conference about how to get grants for electrifying or getting charging units. I mentioned it to a developer. He sent somebody here, and he'd just like to say thank you for the money he just received, and it is putting in electrifying charging units at his multifamily unit. And he will be doing it at a new one that he is getting approved in April when it goes up. But more importantly, in a conversation I had with Damien, he's now going to electrify every parking space in his multifamily unit. It costs $200-$300 to do it ahead of time. You don't have to have the charging unit in it, but if you pre-wired, you're ready to go. That's part of the education that is going on here at the Air District. The third thing is, I brought up the electric vehicle symposium June 14th to 17th. I just got back from Sydney last week. I am amazed. You take this entire room, I call the little cafeteria in the front, it was filled with electric motorcycles for the parking, and you get into the central city. This is catching on. Electric bikes, electric scooters, electric motorcycles. This is catching on fast outside of this country. And we saw the same thing in Singapore the month before. This is going to be here a lot faster than people think.
Director Sinks.
Thank you. Well, to honor Director Sparing's commute pattern, we're going to start meetings next year at 5 a.m., starting with a meeting in Cupertino. We'll time shift we'll set our own precedent. And for those of you who think you might want to take public transit to Cupertino, good luck with that. I'll have to say, check it out on Google. I would love for the situation to be different, but it's really quite impossible. You know, Caltrain is a good bet, but then you're going to have to find your way perhaps on Cupertino's via shuttle. I wanted to make note of something very significant to our community that happened yesterday, and hope, Jack, that you'll follow up in your remarks. Yesterday, the EPA, five states, notably red states, Indiana, Iowa, as well as Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, a local jurisdiction county in Alabama, and this air district, having settled a complaint that they had filed against Lehigh Cement Company for facilities in all these jurisdictions. For us, what this means is there will be a substantial reduction in the next year of some 400 tons of particulate matter. That's condensable particulate matter that comes out of the stack. We don't know exactly how much, but this is a huge big deal, not only for my city, but for the entire South Bay and indeed the region, because at 300 feet where this stuff swims in the air is PM2.5, right? It's affecting the health of all of us. And I'd like to recognize a staff. This has been a large multi-year effort collaborating with these agencies, and this will obviously make a difference to every community in which a cement plant finds itself. So I'd like to thank you for this, and I'm delighted that we were able to participate and get national action on this important health concern. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Jack, do you have a report for us today?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. First of all, I want to correct something. I mentioned the reimbursement for the $3 per meeting, Director Bowders. I want to really recognize Vanessa. She's the one who pioneered this effort, and thank you where she is. Thank you very much for doing that, and it is step one. There's going to be more along those lines. So, Marcy, did you... We have an air quality summary. Thank you. This just is a chart that we use in terms of showing our non-attainment status. It's been raining a lot, as you all know, so that picture really hasn't changed, I think, since you last met. I have a couple of announcements. First of all, I'm very proud of the fact that I get a chance to announce that Brian Bunger has been elected the president of the Air and Waste Management Association for 2021.
No, Dave, we're not going to Hawaii.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Jack.
but we get $3 for walking away.
If you walk to Hawaii, you get more. anyway, yeah, thank you very much, Jack. I'm looking forward to the role in leadership. I was fortunate to have an unopposed run, and yet at the end it was, you know, touch and go whether I would make it. But anyway, I'm looking forward to continuing to work with AWMA and all of you on the dialogue that fosters among industry and government and nonprofits. Thank you.
So next year he'll be president-elect, and the annual meeting will be here in San Francisco.
Right, at the end of June, and then we selected the Orlando area, not at the Disney Resort, but in the Orlando area for the year after.
2021, yeah. Right. So a couple other announcements, Madam Chair. So I wanted to mention, I know Eric, if you can come down and be recognized. Eric Stevenson, this will be his last board meeting. He is somebody who you have heard from multiple times. But he is retiring from the Air District after 30 years. Eric started when he was in junior high. So he is actually, not only has he been our director of our M&M, and I always call it tech because that kind of dates me a little bit, but is also a nationally recognized expert on air monitoring, laboratory tech protocols, just a variety of aspects. So it is not uncommon that Eric oftentimes is called upon to testify, provide presentations on a national level. And so I just want to let you all know that's who Eric is. Not only is he part of our family, part of our executive management team, but also a recognized leader who he will be missed. So I don't know if you want to say anything, Eric.
Thanks, Jack. And, you know, the lessons you learn about public speaking is be brief, be topical. I'll try and do both. Basically, I just want to thank all of you and the executive management team for giving me the opportunity to actually do my dream job. I grew up in the East Bay, and as a kid, I followed the Air District, and the Air District's data helped me win a couple of science projects as I went through school. And at that time, I have a sister and a brother who both had severe asthma. We were in pretty bad shape back then. You couldn't see across the bay when I was a kid. And so, you know, I went to college knowing that I wanted to be in the environmental field. Somehow landed it at the district and was able to be part of some pretty amazing improvements in air quality, primarily with, you know, criteria pollutants at that time. And the improvements that we made were so substantial that my brother and sister didn't suffer many asthma attacks, you know, as I grew up. I think it also speaks to the vision of Jack Broadbent that as we got those successes, we didn't stop there. We've done some pretty substantial reductions of toxic air contaminants. We're doing our best to move forward on GHGs. And I think, you know, the topic that I'd like to touch on is that, you know, there is a little bit of hope. You know, we made some pretty substantial improvements in what was, in my time, you know, air pollution. That definition has grown to be a lot more than it was when I was a child. We've also moved from a regional approach to a much more local approach that I think is going to have tremendous effects on local communities. The Air District has also given me the opportunity to work with, you know, members of industry, with an amazing staff, amazing managers, with community. And if anybody from my childhood were here, they would have said that that was quite unbelievable. I think also one of the things that I get to do is I get to look at all the younger people here, and I have a lot of hope that, you know, I'm going to leave, I'm going to be replaced, and I won't be missed because the staff and the management team here are, quite frankly, amazing. As I've been able to travel and yammer at different places, I have come to the recognition that the people that we've been able to hire, the management team that we've been able to work with, and the staff that we have here is amazing and will continue to drive this district in a way that will achieve improvements that we haven't even thought of yet. So again, I just wanted to thank you for giving me my dream job, allowing me to retire, and the support and the the hope that I have, because all of you and all of you have done a tremendous job. Thank you.
Lastly, Madam Chair, I was going to have Greg just real quickly give you, Director Sinks, building on the point on the EPA CD for Lehigh. Did you want to mention that real quick?
Sure. This was part of a nationwide agreement that the U.S. EPA and Department of Justice negotiated with Lehigh Cement. I was just checking my inbox, and we staff started working on this in 2015. So it's been going on behind the scenes, and we haven't been able to say anything about it for about 4 years, and so we're very happy that it's finally public. One of the key things that we were able to get into the consent decree is a substantial increase in the amount of air pollution control that's injected into the kiln, and we think that will reduce the formation of condensable particulate matter quite substantially. Essentially, you know, if you recall back to the BARC schedule, one of the items that we had on our BARC schedule was to do a cement kiln rule to address condensable PM. And this rule does most of what we were planning. This EPA agreement does most of what we were planning to do in that rule. So we will wait for it to be implemented. We'll retest the kiln and see if progress, sufficient progress was made. And we may be able to call that done, but we'll see what the tests show.
Okay. Great.
That's my report, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Eric, thank you. Your formative adult years were spent here. The only item from my report is to invite everyone to our next Board of Directors meeting, which will be a special meeting held on January 29th. It's a retreat. It's Wednesday, January 29th. It will be in beautiful Cupertino, California. And you can carpool there.
You can carpool.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, if I in your agenda it says the 15th, and so it's a correction. And if you don't mind, I'll just take a moment to explain a little bit. The 15th is the normal schedule. It's the third Wednesday of the month, but it is something that comes up close on us, and we just needed a little bit more time, frankly. And that's what staff has recommended to both you and the incoming chair. I did want to mention also what we're planning to do during that time period, the week of the 13th, the week of the 20th, would be to schedule the legislative road trip. Those are my words, to try to go up to Sacramento. We've talked about it at the Ledge Committee, and we're still trying to pin down dates with legislators and things like that. We could, you know, preserve those times for the road trip, and then we can have our retreat at the 29th. So that's largely what's driving the schedule.
Okay, sounds good. Director Bowders?
I just had one question. Do you think we'll have a meeting then the first week of February, back-to-back weeks, for those of us who have to travel for work?
Our thought was to have the second meeting in February. So.
Okay. All good? Okay. So this meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Happy holidays.